Welcome to the Let's Talk About Care podcast. From carehome.co.uk and homecare.co.uk, the leading reviews websites for care homes and home care.
Hello, I'm Angeline Albert. Welcome to episode 12 of Let's Talk About Care. In the last episode, I spoke to frontline care home worker Enugwum Goodluck. He cared for residents during the pandemic, but was told by the Home Office he would be deported if he didn't leave the country by the 31st of August. A few days before that deadline passed, Mr. Goodluck decided to book a flight to his home country of Nigeria to apply to come to the UK from there. Facing persecution as a Christian by terrorists in Nigeria, Mr. Goodluck has support from UK campaigners who have raised a legal fund for his return. Link to the campaign, Stand With Goodluck. In this episode, we're talking about LGBT plus rights. Why should we care about LGBT rights in care homes and home care agencies? Ramses Underhill-Smith is the Managing Director of Alternative Care Services. It is the UK's first independent LGBT home care organisation. Thank you very much, Mr. Underhill-Smith, for coming to be a guest.
Oh, thanks for having me.
What fueled the decision to create the UK's first home care provider that maintains LGBT plus rights?
I was living in New York, and a friend of mine who was HIV positive gay man was needed to receive social care and was having problems with homophobia from his carers, which was a bit alarming. And so we started talking and I said, oh, you know, I'll set up a care company that with the LGBT focus. And then my sister got terminally ill with cancer. And so I came home from New York, came back to London and realized that the same issues were happening here. And so I decided to set up Alternative Care Services.
How many clients do you have currently?
We've got about 35 clients, predominantly LGBT clients. The whole thing about setting up the agency is to bring awareness, because once I came back here, there was lots of stories of discrimination and alarming stories. People are vulnerable. There was lots of stories of people being bullied, people being ill-treated because of their gender or sexuality. And that's something that we wanted to tackle. I think that with the agency being around now, people are starting to understand. I do talks, etc., care show, and I sort of am an advocate for agencies being able to provide the kind of service that we're providing. The difference is with us is that people know they can nominate, you know, I want a male carer from this community, or I want, you know, I'd like this. They have a preference and we work to fill that preference.
People come specifically for your service because they feel that they will be more accepted.
Not only will you be more accepted, it's very much a cultural thing as well. People think that it actually really doesn't matter. But if you've lived a particular way all of your life, to suddenly have that way of life taken away from you, whatever might happen that you might need care, which means that you might not be as mobile, so you may not be living the life that you used to live, but you want to maintain that part of your identity. And it's just even in terms of in conversations. So often as a caregiver, we're with the client daily, you might not see anybody, you know, to have sort of personal conversations with, apart from our carers. I mean, you want that personal conversation to be free and open, without fear, without judgment. You don't want someone to come in and say, oh, well, why is there no women pictures on the wall? Why is it all men? You know, and be questioning. Those things make you feel not only unsafe, but we know from experience that degrades your health, mental health as well as physical health.
This stems, the campaign work that you do, stems from your own transition as a transgender man. So I was wondering if you could tell me about your experience growing up, the thoughts and the feelings that you had.
Those feelings, the feeling of exclusion from coming from a BAME community is there even today. Homophobia has been encouraged. Transphobia is not even talked about. That's sort of the lowest of the low. And that whole sense of being shamed about who you are. Today in London, and there's certain parts of the community you walk in and the homophobic slurs, whether you're LGBT or not, it's just used as a sort of common everyday term. And for me, it really impacted on my life and my mental health state. And I lived a lot of my life in shame and in hiding, and constantly being afraid that people were going to know who I was.
So when you were growing up as a teenager, growing up as a girl in the household with the family, what kind of struggles did you feel with your own family?
I mean, the struggles with my family is they constantly tried to make me into a girl. So I never fit that. And so I have sisters and, you know, my parents, they didn't understand. It was a very traumatic time growing up. And I just couldn't get it right because that wasn't me. I saw the role models. I just never fit that. And I constantly got it wrong. And that affected my school life. It affected my home life. It affected my relationship with my parents and my brothers and sisters. And I was very isolated. There were 7 of us all together.
Wow.
And 9, including my parents. Mm-hmm. But we're a very close family, which made it even more of a struggle because I was the one that didn't fit in.
How early would you say, when you were a child, did you feel that you didn't fit into the role being played out of a girl?
The earliest memories I can remember when I was about 5, and then my mum being outside the bathroom, about seven, being outside the bathroom, heard the urine stroke, the flow of urine, how it was different. She banged on the door and told me to stop it. So she was clearly alarmed by, she constantly tried to put me in this box, but she wasn't in the room with me, but I was experimenting because I don't even know what came into my head. And she was like, you know, banged on the door furiously, do not do that. And I just kind of thought, wow, so that made me realize. And I don't know if that was my first time doing it, mm-hmm. because maybe it wasn't, maybe I was experimenting all the time, but I remember being caught. She clearly wasn't just walking past the bathroom because I don't know, she must have been listening or what, but the door was locked and I was in there by myself, and I just remembered being petrified. I did think I can't be myself. My brothers are older than me, and then my sisters are younger. You know, I remember doing all the work with my dad. My dad was fine. He was happy teaching me how to paint and that, but my mum was never happy with it. So, you know, she always wanted me to do things that I just couldn't do. She wanted me to type, and my sisters could type, and I just didn't. For her, it was, I think, she just wanted, they were immigrants, they wanted to fit in, and they wanted me to fit in, and there was nothing that she saw about me that made her feel that I was going to fit in and live a comfortable life. In the end, what happened was is that she couldn't get me to conform and be the way she wanted to be, so she gave up. She just gave up trying, which was a feeling of abandonment, because she, you know, she wanted me to wear a dress and she wanted me to do this and she wanted me to do that. And unfortunately for both me and for her, it just wasn't going to happen. You can't, you know, you can't make an oak tree into a rose. It's, an oak tree is an oak tree and a rose is a rose. And you've got to just appreciate those two things for what they are. You know, people pointed it out. Why am I always climbing a tree? Why am I always doing it? Why am I always doing this way? And so I was constantly targeted as not the feminine. This person is not like the others. What's the issue? And when you want to fit into a society, if something makes you stand out, you reject it. When I remember being at school and listening to girls talk about particular things and thinking, God, I don't feel any of those things. Why don't I? And I constantly try to make myself fit in. And a lot of women find it very, very easy. Just feeling all right in my skin. I worked really hard at it, and I never felt that ever until I transitioned. It's extremely difficult for any trans person. I mean, you've got to remember at the time when I was in school, I'm dyslexic, and I remember it when I was in school, there wasn't a diagnosis of dyslexia. There wasn't a lot of diagnosis for lots of things then. I remember watching The Naked Civil Servant with Quentin Crisp, mm-hmm. and I remember being at home watching that, and I remember just feeling revolutionized, thinking, my God, you know, this person is clearly, for me, born a man but represented a woman. And I was transfixed by that. And I think that was one of my earliest memories of feeling that I could actually live the way I wanted to live. When I moved to New York, I saw Quentin in New York. And
did
I, you? Yeah, walking down in Manhattan somewhere. And I just was like, oh my God, my hero. And that was my first real idea of transitioning. It wasn't possible for me to transition and have sanity. So it was a difficult decision to leave, to go. But by that time, I'd been, you know, it was, you know, my mental health would never have survived.
Had you not moved to New York?
Well, I mean, I've been transitioning for ages because I'd always, I sort of I remember trying to live as a lesbian for a long time and having huge arguments with my partners because they kept saying, you're too masculine, you're a man. It's not for me, it's for the fear of my family. Mm-hmm. And not because of the way they're going to treat me, it's because of the way other people are going to treat them. When they are bullied and ostracized and they walk into a room and people talk about them and all of that, you know, it does upset me. It does upset me, but I can't, there's nothing I can do to protect them. You know, I was at my dad's 90th birthday party a couple of years ago. We gave him a party in the Caribbean, and my aunt, you know, my aunt's known me all my life. And I came in and she said to my dad, who is this? You know, she made a big, really tried to embarrass him. And it's that kind of thing that makes you feel really sad. Because, you know, you're my aunt. You've lived with me all of my life and you know who I am. And you've always seen me like this. So why would you, at my dad's party, try and embarrass him in front of all his church friends and all of them? And, you know, and I felt really sad. But, you know, I could see the hurt in him. He's a 90-year-old man. And those kind of things happen to us all. It continues to happen. And in some ways, I feel the hurt. It just makes me wish that people, just didn't think it was acceptable to do things like that. The shaming is a huge, and that's something that people weaponize quite a lot.
That's weaponizing shame.
You know, and everybody doesn't transition in the same way either. But there was never a sort of eureka moment. Yeah, the reason I went to America was that, I could be more comfortable and I could have like-minded people around me. I could have other trans people around me where I could just really, without my, you know, anybody constantly saying, oh, you can't do this or you can't do that, because that's what would have happened. And it's funny because my family then came over to America quite a lot to see me and saw the changes, and then they felt sad. And they felt like, oh, you know, we know it's not been great, but we didn't want you to have to go this far to be yourself. My early years were a difficult journey. My later years, I've got fantastic family. My parents are, my mum, you know, she doesn't understand it, she says, but she is fine. She still calls me by my previous name sometimes, but she corrects herself. Mm-hmm. And the fact that, she, you know, at this age, they try to do it. It's, you know, I love them to death. My whole family is really accepting and appreciative of. I've got children who are, you know, who are great. You know, I've got a better life than a lot of people. I mean, a lot of people don't get to trans. A lot of people, you know, commit suicide and all kinds of things, you know, mental health issues. And I, you know, I don't have those things. I'm really grateful. You know, the ethos for alternative care services is to allow people to be themselves. It's very difficult to even have these conversations. Even in talking to you about it means I'm outing myself again. And so you constantly are outing yourself. But it's important when I go into it, if I go to a community function, that anybody who's young, who has any kind of thoughts of, can I be myself, can see me and think, well, you know what? This person lives a lot amongst us and is respected and, you know, is doing well. And so maybe, you know, I don't think I'm championing, but today I feel brave enough to be able to be visible.
Where was the hometown that you grew up?
Harlesden, yeah, Northwest, next to Kilburn. My sister passed away. We had the funeral at our local church. The minister there, I don't know who told him about me, but he came up to me and said, you know, could you join the church? You know, he wanted me to get involved in the church. He said, we need people like you. We need alternatives. And my mum was just like, she didn't know what to say. In her head, she thought that he was going to say, you know, you need to leave. And she said, well, why do you think they want you? She was asking me afterwards. And I said, well, because they want alternatives, mum, because, you know, there's more people like me and we shouldn't have to hide.
Making people feel included is really what your home care service is all about. Can you tell me what it is that your home care service does for the LGBT plus community? Tell me as well about the term, the LGBTQI plus.
I mean, I say LGBT plus and that incorporates everyone. So lesbian, gay, transgender, bisexual, and everything in between. What we are trying to do is to allow people to be themselves. If you're non-binary, if you're whoever you are, we respect that. We won't come in and say, you know, Mr. So-and-so, or if you might present one way and may want to be addressed another way. So those are the questions we ask. We make sure that you're satisfied, and then we respect your choices. If someone says, you know, I prefer a game male carer, then that's what we'll try and accommodate you with, because I understand, you know, that when I have conversations with my trans friends, it's quite different from when I have conversations with my kids, or it's different from if I have conversations with somebody else. There's a cultural aspect to it. There's an understanding of certain shared experiences, and those shared experiences, I think, when you're older, I think a lot of the times that's taken away from you. Often, if people have disabilities or learning difficulties, you know, they're desexualized. You know, all these things, all your human rights, those emotional rights are taken, physical rights are taken away from you by somebody else making those choices. They decide you cannot do this. One of the things that we're going into now is supported living. We've just launched a campaign called Our House, where we're providing supported living services, accommodation for a young gay man, young gay person with autism. And nobody else understands that. And what does that mean? It means that you want to live your life fully as this particular person, getting support from people who understand what that means. All the services, NHS, everything is heteronormalized. It's Mr. and Mrs. There's no sort of options. You know, once you start to understand people and care about people in a particular way, you have less scope to discriminate or be hateful. I think it brings a better understanding. And because when I understand people better, I care about them more. I empathise with them more.
Can you talk me through some of the challenges LGBT plus people have faced, and what steps your organisation has taken?
I know that people have gone into people's homes and just homophobic comments or transphobic comments. The thing about it is that the carers will feel comfortable doing it if the management is comfortable doing it. So if that's part of office banter, that's what you'll take out into the community, because you then believe everybody thinks the same as you. Simple things like that will make people shut down completely. I've had an instance where a care worker come to work with us, and the person that they used to care for in another company wanted to come over to us as well. And they were saying it took 6 months before they were both comfortable, 6 months before they worked out that they were in the part of the LGBT community. And neither of them wanted to say because they were scared. After 6 months of giving someone care almost every single day, you know, with our staff who are from the community, or from the LGBT community, they feel safe. They can come in and be themselves. And we've had staff that sort of left and come back because they've gone places and they just, you know, the homophobia and the transphobia is horrendous, and they can't work in that environment. So they're scared. Then they're constantly worried about, oh God, I'm going to make sure that nobody at the work finds out, because you go into the office and you hear all these negative comments. And we've had someone last month come back to us because of that.
At this moment in time, the care sector in crisis, recruitment and retention crisis, so many vacancies in the care sector that need to be filled, and not just filled, but with quality staff. It's kind of a win-win situation if care providers try to make their settings more inclusive.
If it's a couple of minority or people, you know, if they're the minority, why make the effort? You know, the extra effort's not worth making. Or, you know, it's not seen as something that we should do. I mean, there was a time when no one spoke about looking after the environment. Now, if you see someone throw paper on the floor, you actually notice it. You think, oh, you know, you might even pick it up yourself. You know what I mean? Because we're more aware of it. And so, you know, trends will change. Globally, we are becoming more and more aware of things. And people are demonstrating and marching and asking for their rights. And before, you wouldn't get media coverage, and now we're getting media coverage. I think more care agencies will start to look at this. But it's like anything; it's going to take time. That one of my things is when I say to people that the management need to be trained. You know, if the management are trained appropriately, they'll make sure the staff are trained appropriately. But if you go into your manager's office and you know, homophobic comments is part of the banter, you're going to feel that's part of, you know, you can take that out into the wider community, because that's what you're getting taught from above, you know, top down. So, yeah.
Alice Wallace, the director of Open Doors London, she has a training which she offers in care settings. This is to home care organisations and care homes. She offers a Pride in Care accreditation.
I think Pride in Care is a great accreditation. You know, we're going through the process ourselves, just because, you know, I'm an ambassador on Opening Doors, so I've always been part of that. I've been part of that organisation for a few years, but and I think that's something that, you know, we talk about sort of personal centred care, and you know, people say, oh, I've often heard it said, oh, we don't have any LGBT clients. And I'm thinking, well, that's probably not true. You just don't know who you have. There's two things about that Pride and Care is that it's guided. And a lot of people, when they come to it, are not going to know. So you can't pick up snippets, or there's not a book that's going to be able to help you. You're going to need proper guidance. And if you go through the accreditation, I understand it takes a while. And then at the end of it, you will have proper guidance and people with proper knowledge. There's going to be two things. If you assign it to one person, if that person leaves, all of that has gone with them. So if you get the organization accredited and few people, and it sort of starts to seep into the culture of the organization, it will remain. Even though we are, you know, that type of organization, that's our focus, we still train all our staff. I mean, I don't take it for granted that I know everything about what it's like to be a gay man. I don't, you know. And so, you know, we all have training. We've all had sort of HIV awareness training that we have blood pathogen training, but we had HIV awareness training from Terence Higgins Trust, which is an HIV prevention organization. So yeah, training is really important, but there is no shortcut. And what will happen is that often what happens is you might get one LGBT person in the organization and everything falls on them and nobody else takes any real interest. And I think that to elicit any real change, it has to be throughout the organization. We need to expect fair treatment from anybody in the care sector, wherever we are. We should expect that.
What are some of the things that you've heard LGBT clients tell you?
Family members who are resentful, you know, why can't they just be like everybody else? You may get to a time where somebody else has got power of attorney and somebody else is looking after your affairs, and but this is what you want. We've had someone say, we try and keep the same people with the same clients, and people, they get on and become really close companions and friends. And then we were told, oh, the carer was grooming a 90-year-old for, you know, grooming him. So all your stereotypes come out. You know, and they're listening on the conversations and they say, oh, that's disgusting. People have the right to have conversations just because it's not part of what you're used to. So that's been good for us because we've had to sort of work out as well as we go along. In some instances, we have to set boundaries so that the client is safe and understands, and so does the care staff. When you've sort of been away from your community and you feel like you're starving, and then something's introduced back to you and you think, oh my goodness, and then you sort of attach to it. So we've had to really look at boundary setting in a healthy way. Because generally, if that person's just been used to having care from an agency that doesn't understand them culturally, and then you don't have the mobility. So you're then cut off from what you've been used to for most of your life, and then that's introduced back to you. It can be like, my goodness, I can't lose this resource, and it reminds you of when you were younger, and all kinds of things come up, and those are the new things that we've been finding. So that before anybody gave this sort of care and support, you didn't know existed.
What would be your do's and don'ts that all care settings should be adopting?
I think the do's would be to get trained, get educated, everybody. But particularly management, higher senior management. I think if it's from the top down, people are more inclined to take it on board. I think the don'ts would be don't assume anything about anyone. Yeah, don't assume anything. Ask questions and ask questions in a non-invasive way. And that, again, I think is something that some people will need to be taught. I know you don't have to come from the LGBT community to give care to the LGBT community, because half of our staff don't. But what's happened is that with the training, that it breaks down stereotypes. So, you know, often they come away saying, I never knew this and I never knew that. And then they feed that back into their communities. You know, I've had people come in and I've said, you know, do you understand we're LGBT focused? And when they've realised what it actually means, they've got up and walked out. And that's fine with us. You know, those are people that we want to employ anyway. And once we go through our employment process, what we then do find is that we have people who are really compassionate.
What kind of evasive questions? Can you give an example of things that really you shouldn't be asking potential residents or clients?
I don't think that you should ask anything that you don't need to know about. So I think it's more giving someone the opportunity to present themselves the way they want to. If you ask a question, you can say, if you're comfortable in answering this, can I ask you this? And give people the option to ask whatever the question may be. People don't mind talking about some people may not, and some people may, but talking about their sexuality or their gender. But I think it's having that choice and feeling safe. If you've grown up in a space where people have not treated you well, or you've witnessed negativity around a particular thing, that's not someone turning up to give you care. And they say, are you gay? You're not going to turn around and say, you're going to say, well, why do they want to know? In your head, you're going to, and you may be, and you may say no. And one of the things that someone said to me was, well, we put it on the questionnaire and nobody ticks the box. People don't tick those boxes because they think, why do they want the information? Well, how are they going to use it against me? People never see it as, they've got that question there because they want to support me in a more personal way. If that's not explained, then you're not going to tick that box, are you? Yeah, you don't want to feel like a curiosity. Because that's a really uncomfortable feeling. I wouldn't want someone to say to me, oh, well, you're trans, so what's it like? You know, do you have the option? I mean, those things for me wouldn't make me feel comfortable. In a care home setting, why shouldn't Laura be able to talk about her time with Jackie and the relationship she had with her partner in a setting and feel safe about it? And sometimes, you know, you might be in a care home and the other residents are hostile. And then, you know, if they are, what's the management going to do about it? Is it going to be again, oh, you're the one person, so we'll just leave it. We'll pretend it's not happening.
What do you think of the CQC guidance on LGBT?
When we first started, we lobbied the CQC for a very long time. We were lobbying them about just classifications and where alternative care services. And one of the things I said to the CQC inspector was that there is no way that people can pick an LGBT organisation. And they said, oh, well, you should just call your name LGBT. And I said, no, we shouldn't. We should be able to call ourselves Joe Bloggs if we want, but that option should be there. And so we fought for a very long time, and I know other organisations did as well, for them, and then they came out with the recommendations. But that was 2 years of campaigning. They said everybody should get equal care, and I said, well, that's actually not true. Everybody should get care that's relevant to them. So then I said, well, what would you do if someone was transgender and they'd forgotten they transitioned because they have dementia and then woke up, they didn't know what to do, what would the carer do then? And then they said, oh, we'll get back to you, because I think that's when they realised, actually, it's not about equal care for everybody, it's about the right care.
Well, what should a care setting do then if someone has dementia and they had transitioned?
Like I say, I think that everyone should be trained. I think everybody, because you'll know that person. And again, if someone has any form of dementia, you would know how to calm that person, you know, how to best facilitate and support that person and what they've gone through in life. Then you'll be able to support them much better. It's the lack of training and the lack of awareness. And, you know, because that's what people say. I don't have it. I don't know anything about it. I don't. And it's just training.
Someone who has dementia, who has forgotten, they can't remember transitioning.
It will be on a day-to-day basis. They need to be treated on that day how they choose to be on that day. And however they want to be treated, you know, I have heard stories of people, family members, transitioning people back. Once they've got senior and they've had dementia, they've transitioned them back. It's not your right to do that to somebody else just because you now have power of attorney. That's an abuse. That, for me, that's abusive. You know, just because that person doesn't have capacity anymore, if they were living that way and they'd never decided that they wanted to go, but you don't have that right. And I would fight for that person to remain the way that they wanted to be. It's, you know, we don't inflict ourselves and our issues on other people.
This training and education, you are now currently going through the Pride in Care accreditation yourselves?
We have our own training, our in-house training that we've developed, obviously, because we've been going for a few years now. But going through the Pride in Care also means that I can say to anybody else, you know, I don't provide training. So I think it's important that there is somewhere that people can get that training. We've set up our supported living company called ACS Plus, and we had to write our articles of memorandum. I think that's the first article of memorandum in this country that's gender neutral. You look up our articles, you'll see it says they, them, themselves, because it has he, she, and we stripped all of that out. We know that anxiety, fear, all of those things can overrun any individual, no matter who you are. And it's just waking up and knowing when your carer comes, I can relax. You know, it's someone that I feel completely safe with, and it's safety.
You were considering setting up a care home.
Yeah, there's a demand there. One of the things that we've been asked a lot now is about care homes, because, you know, people want care homes, and some of our clients are now needing to go into care homes. And I would need to feel that I could make the, keep my clients as safe as possible, and we would be a new care home establishment. We have clients who are supporting their partners and need respite, but there is a need. But yes, it's a difficult call, particularly at this time.
Thank you very much indeed for talking to me today.
Thank you so much.
I'm here now with Alice Wallace, the director of Opening Doors London.
Pleasure to have you here as a guest on Let's Talk About Care podcast.
Hi, great to be here. Thank you for talking about the needs of older LGBT people.
Can you tell me about your organisation?
We were set up in the early 2000s to support the needs of older gay men. And since then, we've become more inclusive. So now that we're an organisation supporting LGBT plus people who are over 50. And from our humble beginnings of Camden, in North London. Now we provide services across the UK to people who are 50 plus and LGBT.
And what kind of services do you provide?
I guess we're an organisation that's got two main themes. We've got one that's providing services directly to older LGBT people. So pre-lockdown, we were providing over 40 different activities and events every month. We have got a befriending service where we're supporting around 100 older, less mobile members. We were providing some specialist support, and we also had an intergenerational volunteering program. Needless to say, over the last few months, all of that has gone either by now virtual or on the phone. So it's provided opportunities as well. So we've been able to provide set up a new carer support group, which probably works better online than it would do if people were having to schlep halfway across London to meet up. And the other side of our work is working specifically with housing, health and social care organisations to support them in their providing inclusive care services so they're meeting the needs of older LGBT people. And we do that by providing training and support and our national quality standard, Pride in Care.
Pride in Care. Can you tell me about that?
So this was something that we launched 2 years ago because there wasn't any national accreditation that organisations could apply to. If they wanted to evidence that they were providing inclusive care, you know, an organisation will go through a number of assessment criteria. There's a staff survey. We look at their policies and procedures. There's a workbook that organisations work through. And when they've compiled all that information, then they press the sort of submit button, and we do some other assessments of looking at their website and maybe talking to their residents, maybe some mystery shopping. It's a building a relationship with the organisation so that by the time they come to submitting, hopefully they've got, you know, all their ducks in a row, because if they've got queries or questions or some of their policies are not right, they've been talking to the team, we've been able to provide them with model documents that they can have a look at and they can amend to fit their specific situation. Yes, if they're awarded Pride in Care, that accreditation lasts for 3 years.
The CQC says providers have a duty to promote equality, diversity and human rights in their service, including for their staff. Providers need to promote LGBT plus inclusive practices. People need to be proactively supported by staff to understand the need to adequately balance risk and responsibility towards the person that they care for. How closely aligned are you with the Care Quality Commission?
We have a relationship with CQC. They know that they can point organisations in our direction if they come across organisations that are struggling with these issues. We delivered a webinar to a number of organisations to say, hey, you know, in terms of addressing the issues of working with old LGBT people, here are some things that you can do. Here are some of the ways that you can make sure that you're, when the assessors ask what you're doing to specifically meet the needs of older LGBT people, you're not just saying, oh, We treat everybody equally, because if you want to provide personalised care, then you've got to understand where the life story of people and what they've been through. Any organisation that was going through Pride in Care, that went through Pride in Care, they would have something that they could give to the inspectors, CQC inspectors, to to say, yeah, actually, we are doing something different. We are making sure that we're aware of what those needs and that experience might have been and how that's now impacting on how somebody is presenting and what their needs might be. You know, it's a really valuable resource for organisations in terms of improving their rating. You know, when we ask whether they've overheard any homophobic comments or bullying activity, there's a higher number of people who've said, yes, they've witnessed homophobia going on either against staff or clients, but they don't know how to respond. And they go, well, it's not my responsibility, is it? It's an HR thing. And yet they're not actually escalating it to HR, so they're not necessarily doing anything about it. So there's something there that care homes can do to ensure that staff know what to do. The HR department, if they have one, should know about such incidents. They should be logged. We had a number of organisations who'd signed up who then, because of COVID, deprioritised going through the assessment, but are now starting to get back in contact. This isn't about being politically correct. This is about providing personalised care to our residents, to our beneficiaries, to our clients. If organisations, care homes are seen to do that, then you know they're opening up a new market. You know, if you imagine, you know, we know that sort of around 7% of the population identifies as LGBT. So we know that that's a significant market that organisations could be tapping into. So one example for a care home, they said, well, we've got a new resident, and sometimes they think they're a man and sometimes they think they're a woman. And what do we do? And I said, well, if the person is presenting as a woman today and saying they want to dress in women's clothing, then if you're providing personalised care, why should that matter? Who's getting distressed about this? Is it the client or is it your staff? And if it's your staff, then there's some training needs there. If it's the client, why are they getting distressed? How are your staff supporting them? We've also had, you know, examples when the care worker has learned the sexuality of their client. Then even though they're being paid to help maintain the client's independence, have then gone, well, I'm not touching that person because, you know, they're queer. And we've had other examples of clients, members having negative comments from care workers who've been going into their home. We had one member who then said, I don't need to have any care support anymore. And clearly they did. And what they did in that time then was take everything, all their personal memorabilia, out into the back garden, into the backyard, and burn it. But the next time somebody came into their home, then they wouldn't be subject to the abuse that they'd been subjected to.
If anybody wants to get in touch and start this road to Pride in Care accreditation, what's the best way for them to contact you?
They can either email prideincare@openingdoors.org.uk or they can email training@openingdoorslondon.org.uk.
Thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you for the opportunity of talking about these issues and hopefully improving the lived experience of older LGBT people.
Research has shown that LGBT people tend to receive lower levels of care than non-LGBT individuals. The CQC has stated, we have focused in the past 2 years on improving how we look at person-centred care for people in LGBT communities and adult social care. This work has led to increased confidence in inspectors asking questions about LGBT equality and then including this in inspection reports. A report by MPs sitting on the Women and Equalities Committee found, while few people set out to discriminate, training currently sends the message that sexual orientation and gender identity are not relevant to providing person-centred care. Alice Wallace says, anyone wanting to get person-centred care right must champion the inclusive care that comes with LGBT plus training. As Mr. Ramses Underhill Smith says, no one wants to feel like a curiosity. I hope you found useful this episode of Let's Talk About Care. If you would like to share your comments about this episode, you can email podcast@carehome.co.uk, search carehome.co.uk on Facebook, or you can tweet @carehome_co_UK. Thanks for listening.
The Let's Talk About Care podcast.